Welcome to a special episode of Trial Lawyer View, where we are going to dive into a couple of remarkable cases in the area of child safety. In today's episode, I get the chance to sit down with James Swartz, managing attorney at Swartz & Swartz PC, and a nationally recognized attorney and consumer advocate. With decades of experience in litigating catastrophic injury, wrongful death, and products liability cases, Mr. Swartz brings a wealth of knowledge and expertise to our conversation today. From his groundbreaking work with World Against Toys Causing Harm, Watch, to his commitment to educating the public on toy safety, Mr. Swartz has made significant contributions to consumer protection and advocacy. Mr. Swartz's law practice is headquartered in the historic John and Ebenezer Hancock House on the Freedom Trail in Boston, Massachusetts. He has successfully represented plaintiffs in states across the country involving large, complex civil litigation claims, including catastrophic injury, wrongful death, products liability, medical malpractice, and other significant personal injury cases. He has numerous awards and recognitions, including being a Massachusetts super lawyer since 2004 and attaining an AV rating from Martindale Hubbell. He has authored and co-authored numerous articles and book chapters relating to child, medical, and product safety. James, welcome to Trial Lawyer View. I appreciate you taking the time to be with me here today.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
So, you know, we had talked a little bit before the podcast started about Watch, and I wanted to see if you could talk about maybe the top five insights from your role as a consumer advocate and the founding of World Against Toys Causing Harm, which is the acronym WATCH.
Sure. So WATCH, I'm a director of WATCH currently, a nonprofit group, as you mentioned. WATCH, the genesis of WATCH is really started with my dad. I had the good fortune of working with him many years ago. He's no longer with us, but an incredible body of work, including consumer activism and child safety focus and toy safety. And so that was really WATCH started back in the 70s, late 70s, or at least the genesis of it, when there was no Consumer Product Safety Commission, really no regulations to speak of. He testified before Congress, brought up literally a bag of toys. He was the only consumer advocate out there really as a voice for kids. And things on the marketplace at that time included, you know, dolls with pins in their hair and books. Literally bows and arrows being sold as toys, if you can imagine that. And so anyhow, so that led to the formation of WATCH ultimately in the 80s and the advocacy for child safety and making sure the public is aware of the issues that are going on with these toys that make their way to the shelves. And I think the biggest takeaway for us and what we try to communicate over the years is not to assume that toys are safe just because they're on the shelves and available for sale, right? There certainly are regulations out there. There's testing that's supposed to happen, but those regulations are minimum regulations. They're not adequate. And so there are toys constantly making their way to the shelves that are the subject of recalls, that have defects, and that have caused serious injuries and deaths.
And I know from the research and our conversation before this podcast that you litigate in this area, and that, you know, some of the issues that you deal with in terms of your practice are things like hidden defects, slow reactions by manufacturers when there are defects and there's known injuries and death from those defects, you know, how these hazardous products can make their way onto the shelves for children to be harmed by, and recalls and all of that. Out of those sorts of issues, what do you find is the most major issue you come across in terms of your litigation in this area, or even through WATCH? Those questions really kind of triggered in my mind when I was seeing kind of those sorts of issues being at the forefront of this type of litigation with these products.
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I think the one overarching theme that comes to mind, sadly and tragically, is that the companies involved with the manufacturing, the distribution, the marketing, the testing of a lot of these products are focused on, as I said, there's the marketing component, but aren't focused enough on the safety issues. And so what happens is with a lot of these products, these toys that get out in the marketplace, or children's products, other products, of course, is that the public essentially becomes a testing ground. You know, so these products are out there, children in this case, we're talking about toys and related products, children are using these products, and then there starts to be injuries, or there might be, God forbid, deaths. And so these numbers start to rise, and the manufacturers are either don't respond or are slow to respond, unless they're, of course, forced to respond. And that's where I think the power of litigation really comes in. You know, one thing I realized really early on in my career, and one thing I love about the work I do and attorneys like myself do, is that there is that power in, with the right case and the clients on board with us. And we have a lot of clients that come to us and say, you know, we want to make sure this doesn't happen to someone else. That's a perfect client for us, right? Is that we can actually effectuate change. We've seen design changes. We've seen recalls. We've seen regulations, among many other things, that have come from litigation that and cases that we prosecuted over the years. So that's a really important aspect, I think, of what I do and we do as trial attorneys.
Yeah, and I mean, there's, you know, some really important things that have come from that. And for example, automotive litigation over defects in vehicles that could have been easily fixed with small tweaks or changes either in design or fixes after a defect becomes known. I'm curious, in this specific area, is it typically the process of developing these toys are such that there's just a lack of enough research into the potential harm that design can cause, or is it just simply low-cost manufacturing that's done, you know, in somewhere in Asia or somewhere really to minimize cost that then exposes children to harm?
Yeah, so we've seen both, really. So on the manufacturing side, as we all know, it's become more of a global economy, and a lot of big U.S. manufacturers, of course, are using overseas manufacturing sites, different companies that, you know, they contract with who are building their products, right? And of course, it remains the responsibility of the U.S. side manufacturer to be sure that these products are made pursuant to specs, are safety inspected, all of that. But sometimes there have been manufacturing defects that have occurred that are not caught, that are, you know, they come over here, they're just put right on the shelves. And that's what I meant by, you know, the focus on the bottom line rather than safety issues and protecting our children, right? So that's the manufacturing component. But the other component, like you referenced, is, you know, what testing is really being done. And by the way, I mentioned regulations and testing standards as being inadequate. We've seen over and over again where manufacturers will come in and they'll say, well, you know, we complied with those standards, you know, the toy industry standards or the ASTM standards, whatever applies. And so we're good. You know, our responsibility ends there. Well, it doesn't, right? Because they know how their product is going to be used better than a legislator up on Capitol Hill. So knowing that, knowing how children are going to use these products in a foreseeable manner, it's their responsibility to understand that and to make these products safe for anticipated uses and misuses, by the way. And so that's where the disconnect, I think, really is. We don't have a robust enough testing standard in this country. We don't have a robust enough regulatory standard. And the manufacturers aren't doing enough to close that gap so that when their products are getting out into the shelves, they're as safe as they can be for those anticipated uses. And that's where the real trouble begins.
So I want to shift gears. Your firm has been involved in some notable cases, and I wanted to ask you about a couple. One jumped out at me being here in Florida, and you know, over the years, having seen quite a few drowning cases, it is a drowning case, but it was a little unique to me because of the fact that this was a drowning that I think occurred, and you can confirm, at a day camp, because there was some discussion in the facts of this case that there was video surveillance that showed approximately 4 minutes of footage of a child struggling to stay above water and then ultimately being underwater. I think what I saw was 1 minute of trying to stay above water and 3 minutes underwater. And I know that you got a good result in that case. Can you talk us through the key strategies you used to resolve the case and secure compensation ultimately for the survivors? Because sadly, the child didn't survive that.
Yeah, that was an incredibly tragic case. It was the only child of this couple, young child, 9 years old. And the day camp was at a country club site. And so the country club during the summer months, this was down in the Carolinas, the country club ran a day camp, and it was kind of a multi-purpose camp. You know, there was tennis, there was different types of sports, and then there were free swim periods, right, at certain times of the day. And this was during one of those periods. And actually, when this tragedy occurred, it was the very first day of camp. And so the check-in process was the mom, in this instance, brought the child to the front desk. They check him in. They asked some basic questions, including, by the way, about swimming ability, which he communicated. He's not a swimmer. There were some factual disputes there, but this is what the mom did. And then during the free swim, as you said, this tragedy occurred. One big issue in this case was, as you pointed out, the time frame involved when this child was drowning. And what a lot of folks don't realize is that drowning is typically silent, right? It's not, you know, in the movies, you think about, you know, the kicking and screaming and splashing. More typically, what happens is a child, like in this instance, is underwater and there's no sounds, there's no splashing. And that's why it's so critical to have the right personnel in place and to have the right standards in place as a camp. So this particular camp, we learned, had one lifeguard at one far side of this large pool. There were about maybe 30 to 40 kids from different parts of the camp in this pool. The counselors were standing around the pool with no particular responsibility for any group of kids. There was no buddy system, nothing like that. And so as we got into the case, we started learning more and more about that. And you mentioned, I believe, video footage, which was critical in establishing the time period involved. Because these types of things, if there are enough lifeguards and enough folks who know exactly what they're doing and who they're supposed to be watching, this kind of thing would be picked up pretty quickly. And then that's the whole point, right? So then somebody like this poor child would be rescued. That wasn't done here. And so one of the biggest things that came out of this case that we learned also is that in North Carolina, where this was, there were no standards, if you can believe it, that required a camp like this to have a certain number of lifeguards, let's say one lifeguard per six or eight kids. If they had this camp at the YMCA, those standards would be in place. It made no sense. The safety issues are the same. And so that was an example of a gap, a terrible gap in the law. And the laws in a lot of states have this. There's gaps. That unfortunately, the day camp decided not to address. And as a result, there was a tragedy.
So how did you ultimately get that case in a posture to resolve? Because it sounds like that still would present a lot of challenges in terms of defense, because I can see from how you described that probably would be a case where they would defend, you know, that there are no requirements or regulations in the state. So how did you guys wind up, you know, really bringing that case to be positioned such that you could resolve it?
Yeah, so I think this case and just like really any case involving a child who's terribly injured or dies tragically, the key, one of the big keys, is making sure the focus remains on the defendant's actions, whether it's the product, making the product, in this instance, the lifeguard issue, right? And because the focus, of course, by the defendants is 100% of the time, the parent, you know, lack of supervision, or in this drowning case, while the mom didn't communicate at all or inadequately about, you know, the swimming ability of this child, right? So what's really important to do is to make sure, and through the discovery is so critically important, of course, and taking depositions of the key people, is establishing those safety issues and violations of safety. So even though, as you point out, and as we're talking about, the regulations didn't require, for example, an extra lifeguard or extra lifeguards around the pool, what we were able to establish is that the camp and those who ran the camp were aware that there were certain safety issues involved here, and that they didn't address, regardless of what the regulations were, they failed to address them adequately. And that was a cause of what happened here. And so it's kind of an intricate process, right, to your point, to kind of put that those puzzle pieces together, really, to get to the point where you're able to resolve these cases either through settlement or going all the way through trial. But if you carefully map out your case and where you need to get to, it certainly can be done, and can be done very effectively.
Yeah, and I know ultimately it was a seven-figure recovery, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, that was a $6 million recovery in North Carolina, yeah.
Yeah. Well, there was another case that I wanted to ask you about, and I know that it's subject to confidentiality. It involved a container that a child became entrapped by. And I from the research, I know that you had to overcome an aggressive defense in that case, given the facts. But I wanted to ask you a little bit about that case and how you leveraged the strengths in that case to also get a good outcome. Because from the facts of that case, the child did survive, but suffered a significant traumatic brain damage injury, which I know, because having been involved in those cases for years, there's massive damages and a ton of future care that's needed that you've got to ultimately, hopefully, recover for that child's future.
Yeah, so that case, as you point out, horribly tragic. This child lived in an apartment complex with his mom, his grandma, and found his way into this container and became, as he was climbing out of this container, which, by the way, is not for children, it's not intended for children. And so that was part of the challenge of the case that you alluded to. But it looked like he got into the side of this container, and as he was trying to exit, became entrapped, his neck and his head between the lid and the side of the container. His airflow was restricted, and he suffered a terrible brain injury. And so the challenge there, similar to what we just talked about, right, was with this container, which, as I said, is not intended for children, how do we establish the liability? And I was confident, you know, I looked at this case, I from the beginning, in terms of the legal issues, I felt like there was something about this case that really, you know, resonated with me in terms of child safety issues. And as I got into the case, one thing I learned, or some many things I learned, one of which was the placement of this container. So this container, I mentioned it was an apartment complex. This container was placed within approximately, let's say, 40 to 50 feet of a playground area. So I immediately started thinking about attractive nuisance, right?
And I was going to ask you about that because I'm wondering.
Right. And as attorneys, you know, that's a term we're familiar with. And, you know, being that close to a playground, to, and also the other thing I think it's really important to do is think from the child's perspective, right? So a child going out to the playground sees this container within 40, 50 feet. To a child, this is all one play area. And there was, by the way, a grassy area in between, right? There was no, the fence was open. It was no, it wasn't locked. The container wasn't locked. And so to a child, oh, look, there's another piece of play equipment, arguably. And so that's where we went with it in terms of developing the theories in the case, among other things. You know, there was a lid that really, this lid that we're talking about, there was no reason for it to be unlocked. It didn't need to be used. Had the owner of the property, manager of the property, simply got a padlock at the hardware store, locked it down, this tragedy would have been avoided. So things like that, again, focusing on, in this case, the product itself and the conduct of the defendants versus, of course, as we talked about earlier too, the supervision issues. You know, while this child was out alone, even though the family could look from the window and see where he was, they weren't physically out with him. And so that became a big issue to overcome in the case for sure.
But ultimately, your strategies and methods that you undertook to prove your case wound up resulting in another seven-figure settlement in that instance.
Yeah, so that one we resolved for the family. It was an $18 million resolution. And when I checked, the largest or the second largest settlement in Massachusetts the last couple of years. But the best part about that is this child, being able to get this child set up for his life, to make sure he gets the care he needs, the living space he needs with his mom. So it changed his life and her life. And so as trial lawyers and doing these kinds of cases, getting to a result like that and being able to help in some way is incredibly gratifying. And it really was a terrific result, mainly for that reason.
Yeah, and we've seen that over the years, and I've seen it personally in my career in working with people that have been catastrophically injured. You know, that kind of money, while it's a lot of money, it does, you know, sometimes pale in comparison to really what all of the needs are, and oftentimes they do need Medicaid or, you know, other types of government assistance to supplement, because, you know, it's rare that you get that much money. But even that much money, when you've got $100 million or $75 million in future care for, you know, a child over their lifetime, you know, it's not that much money. But it does make sure that ultimately those kinds of needs are addressed. And that's an incredible opportunity to help somebody, which is something that, you know, I always talk to our team about, because, you know, we're involved in part of that, you know, particularly in trying to get, you know, a substantial lien resolved, is that those dollars are what's important for future care and taking care of that person after they've been injured in these types of cases. So it is a really important thing that ultimately we all get, you know, the opportunity to help a little bit with.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely.
So last question, I wanted to ask you, in terms of Watch and cases like the ones we just talked about, you know, all of that is powerful messaging about the importance of safety and security of our children. And I've got three, so I, you know, these things always scared me. Mine are adults now, but still, you know, then grandkids after that. What do you ultimately hope, you know, you accomplish in terms of improving safety practices and preventing those similar incidents in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think when you ask that question, I think of two main areas. One is an area that we talked a little bit about earlier, which is effectuating change on the manufacturing side, the retail side, marketing, you know, whether it's design changes, adding safety elements to the design, recalls, all those kinds of things, which are really important. The other piece of it, though, that is just as important is the educational part and the informational part, right? So in other words, how can we get the word out to families, to caregivers of children who are either shopping for toys and other children's products, or who might receive, you know, as gifts, those types of products, for example. And so Watch, one purpose of Watch as a nonprofit group is to do just that, is to get the word out throughout the year, really, but certainly during the holiday season, especially when people are paying more attention. You know, what are the safety issues to look out for? You know, small parts, long cords, electrical hazards, chemical hazards, and on and on. We want folks to know that those issues still are out there and they still need to know what to look for. And what we do is use toys as teaching tools, you know, so we'll literally go shopping each year for Watch, and we'll use toys as examples. You know, here's something you can find literally on the shelf this season, and here's what you need to know about it and other toys like it. So we use them as examples. You know, it has might have a small part like a, that pulls out of like a bow in the hair or something like that. And so by using those examples, tactile examples with the public, with caregivers, with parents, we hopefully provide the tools so that when they go shopping or receive gifts, they know, okay, I can't assume this is safe necessarily. I need to know what the hazards are. I need to know how to look for those hazards. And so that's really a goal, whether it's with the cases, getting the information out like you're helping me do right now, or through nonprofit work like Watch, those educational efforts, I think, are really important.
Well, I just want to say I really, truly appreciate what you are doing in this specific area. I know your practice is diverse and you handle product liability and MedMal, but I thought this particular, you know, things like Watch and the cases that you, some of these cases that you've handled that impact child safety is an important thing to talk about. And for other trial lawyers who have cases out there who might, you know, need your kind of expertise and assistance. So if anyone who's listening to the podcast is interested in co-counseling with you or wants to refer a case, or has any questions about anything you've talked about today, Watch, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Yeah, through the website, swartzlaw.com, SWARTZLAW.com, or my direct email, jswartz, that's jswartz@swartzlaw.com are great ways to be in touch. Or the phone number, 617-742-1900. We get calls all the time from folks around the country. We co-counsel around the country. And so, and by the way, doesn't even have to get to that level. If some of your listeners may simply have questions about ongoing cases, you know, what experts to look for, some liability issues they want to kind of pick my brain about, I'm always happy to hop on the phone or have an email exchange with someone about all those kinds of things.
That's one of the beautiful things about the plaintiff's bar I so appreciate is the fact that there is that kind of willingness. And obviously, you know, certain cases are such that it probably does make sense to co-counsel or refer them out, depending on expertise and what areas you focus on. But it's awfully nice of you to offer that to any listeners who might have questions. And we'll include your contact information in the show notes for anyone that wants to just click on it as well. And thank you for being a guest here on Trial Lawyer View today. And we'll see everybody on the next episode.
Jason, much appreciated. Thank you.